Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
I'm Smitha Reddy, U.S. Chair of Brand at Edelman. I'm joined today by Nisha Raghavan, Chief Marketing Officer, North America for Number 7 Beauty Company, a Walgreens Boots Alliance standalone beauty business. In her role, Nisha leads brand marketing, digital transformation, and communications for iconic consumer-led brands such as Number 7, Soap & Glory, and Boots Ingredients. She has a longtime history in the CPG space and previously held roles at Unilever and PepsiCo. Nisha is an innovative thinker, trailblazer, and an expert of brand and digital marketing. We're so excited to have her on the show. Nisha, welcome to the Trustmakers.
Thanks, Smitha. It's great to be reunited with you. I don't know if a lot of people know this, but we used to work together when I was a brand manager at Unilever and you were my lead at Edelman. So it's so great to be with you again.
We are thrilled to have you on the show. You've been on my list of people that I've wanted to sit down and chat with and just hear about you and your story, which I think is so interesting. So let's get started about you. Maybe tell the audience a little bit about your career and your journey and how you got into your current role.
Yeah, sure. So I started my career in advertising, working at one of the big ad agencies in New York, then went off to get my MBA and went client side after that. So I joined Unilever, spent 6 wonderful foundational years working on brands like Dove and Axe, launching Simple, a brand new brand for us at the time, and loved it there. But by then, the digital revolution had begun, and I really wanted more e-commerce experience, so I left Unilever. And since then, I've gotten a huge range of experiences. So I've been in CPG businesses, direct-to-consumer companies, big and small companies. I've been in unicorn, you know, high growth type of businesses, as well as turnaround businesses, quite the range. And I think that's one of the things that helped me land my current CMO role at Number 7 Beauty Company. I'm sure we'll get more into the brands and everything, but we, you know, we have a portfolio of beauty brands that have a wide range of challenges and opportunities. So the breadth of skill sets that I had developed really worked in my favor. So that's how I got to where I am today.
I love your journey in terms of where you got to and some of the experiences that you've had. We talk a lot about the CMO role and just how complex and how it's like currently evolving at each and every day. And I know you've chatted about this as well. So can you elaborate a little bit on like what's different now? What's a typical day like for you? And how have you kind of adapted to these changes throughout your career?
Yeah, I mean, it is so different from when I was graduating school. When I was graduating, if you wanted to be a CMO going to the big CPG companies, you know, the PepsiCos, the Unilevers, the P&Gs, that was the end all be all. That was the path to CMO. And those CPG companies, I mean, I'm still very grateful that I had my foundation there because you learn to think strategically. You are general manager of your brands. You learn to think about a P&L, but you're also building these, you know, national or in some cases global big campaign ideas. You're building product pipelines, really, you know, learning how to harness an insight and build a brand positioning. So there's just so much great experience you get in CPG, and I wouldn't have traded that experience for anything. But when I graduated, digital marketing wasn't a thing. And today it's, you know, at least half, if not more, of the job. And so the path to CMO looks so different today. It's very fragmented. There's engineers rising up to CMO roles now. And, you know, the understanding of technology and how to leverage technology to connect with the consumer differently, be that a platform like social media platforms or be that MarTech, is super critical. And that's one of the reasons that I've moved back and forth between CPG and DTC to get that kind of experience. And so however you get it, as a CMO today, I think you have to think even more broadly than you used to even just 10 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that sort of speaks to what we're seeing in the marketplace too. It might not be full, you know, brick and mortar retail, it might not be full D2C, but truly that idea of, you know, being omnichannel and showing up at the right places and the right times for different audiences that you're trying to reach. So to level set for our audience, can you just explain a little bit about how Walgreens Boots Alliance works within the structure, or how is Number 7 Beauty Company structured within that?
Everybody knows Walgreens, huge retailer in the US. If you've been to the UK, you probably know Boots, huge retailer out in the UK. And the two companies merged in 2015. And so that's where Walgreens Boots Alliance was formed. The Boots side of the business has had this portfolio of iconic beauty brands for almost 100 years. And that company within the company was called Global Brands Group for a long time. And their brands, like you said, you know, Number 7 is our flagship brand, Soap and Glory, Liz Earle, Sleek, Botanics, Boots Ingredients. It's this really great portfolio of skincare and cosmetics brands. And many of them are number one in their categories in the UK. So we decided a year ago to rebrand that company as the Number 7 Beauty Company to give it its own identity, because we were expanding globally, including North America. So in the US, for example, we have been on a pretty fast growth trajectory the last few years, expanding distribution outside of Walgreens. We're now at Walmart, Target, Ulta Beauty, Kroger, and also expanding our number of brands. We've launched new brands in the last couple of years. Expanding our target audiences. And so we really felt like with this global footprint, we needed the company to have a new name and an identity that made a little bit more impact than Global Brands Group. So that's how Number 7 Beauty Company was born. But again, these brands have been around for a long time in the UK.
You talk a little, you know, it's interesting in terms of, you know, the longevity of these brands. And when we were talking about, you know, just some of the history behind them, you know, and then how do you take these brands and bring them into the future? You know, we've seen through our own trust barometer research, the new cascade of influence, we found that, you know, 57% of Gen Z and 60% of millennials believe the brands can do more to solve societal problems than government, right? And so when you think about 100-year-old brands, and I know you guys are playing in the social issue space, how do you find that authenticity for these brands? Like, what is your sort of way in?
Yeah, I mean, authenticity is absolutely critical. And all brands know that, you know, consumers expect brands to take social action. But it's those brands that do it for the sake of doing it that fall down, right? And so for Number 7, our flagship brand, we have an 86-year history of supporting women's empowerment. So our founder, this woman named Florence Boot, so inspiring. I go back to the archives in the UK and I just like light up every time. She, you know, she was putting women in pants in her ads when other brands were putting women in housewife dresses. And she was educating her beauty consultants, her employees, making sure that they stayed up with their education when, you know, others were expecting them to just sort of come in and have a pretty smile. She was teaching them about the science of skin, not just how to smile at the counter. So she was very much about female empowerment and really created this idea of beauty in a chemist shop or in a pharmacy, and supported women all throughout. And so that has always been part of our DNA through the decades. So one example of how we brought this to life is last year in the height of COVID-19, we were seeing a trend in the labor stats that showed that women were leaving the workforce at 4 times the rate of men. And it's because when schools shut down and daycare centers shut down, the burden of care still falls on the woman, unfortunately. And so women were leaving the workforce in droves. And then also women were more represented in industries that were hard hit by COVID, such as the hospitality industry. And so this was something we wanted to take on as an issue. It was very much part of our DNA, being all about female empowerment. And we built a program to attack what, you know, got coined as the She Session. And so what we did was, you know, one part kind of awareness driving. So we drove awareness in the marketplace of this issue to get more brands, more partners around the issue. And then the action that Number 7 took was to build a job summit. It was a virtual job summit, the biggest of its kind, where we had amazing inspirational speakers like Arianna Huffington and Maria Shriver talking about things like ageism. But we also had authors and HR executives talking about the practical, you know, if you've lost your job and been out of the workforce for a year, what do you do? And then we followed that with some smaller group training sessions on specific topics. So all in all, we impacted 10,000 women. It was one of the highlights of my career. But again, it was very much tied to our DNA of, you know, sticking with what we've always been about, which is female empowerment. So I think that, you know, consumers expect brands to take that stance. It is sometimes hard in bigger companies because you've got a lot of opinions and a lot of stakeholders, but you also have the budgets to do it. And it's up to brands to, you know, to make that movement.
I love that work. And I think we were all following what was happening at the height of COVID with the She session. And I do think it's such a interesting way that Boots found an opportunity to create a solution for women and tying it back to the history. I loved hearing about, you know, this idea that women at the counter were taught to smile and you guys were teaching them about skincare and the science behind skincare. And I think that's so interesting. And I think it's interesting, especially as we look at, you know, the looming sort of recession that hits us and how Boots can continue to make impact there. You know, what strikes me is that I do think that the beauty industry has been really far ahead when it comes to taking on some of these societal issues, be it, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, or women, female empowerment, or even just planet positive, or, you know, doing better for the planet. And actually, if you look back like 20 years ago, it was probably the fashion industry that was leading. Why do you think that beauty is kind of ahead a bit more in this space?
I think there's a lot of reasons. I mean, one reason is because, you know, beauty has been criticized as an industry that perpetuated self-esteem issues. Obviously, Dove Real's beauty campaign is very famous now. And that was one of the first brands that took a stance in the industry for societal good. And I think a lot of brands followed, but because of the nature of beauty, it can either destroy diversity and inclusion and self-esteem, or it can build it up. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons maybe the beauty industry is ahead in terms of taking that stance. Cause as an industry and as a category, we have more impact on those issues than maybe some other categories do. The other thing is that beauty just lends itself to inclusion, right? It's all about self-expression. It's a fun category, but it also can be isolating. And so things like shade extensions, making sure a cosmetic brand has shades that include everybody, making sure that you're representative in influencer marketing, those are really big issues in the beauty industry. And I think, again, it puts us ahead in the conversation because we're faced with those issues as marketers in this industry. So I think the nature of the industry lends itself in so many different ways to having to be responsible and also being able to be creative around how you bring people together in a creative, fun way.
I want to kind of switch topics a little bit and talk about Gen Z, because I think everyone's talking about Gen Z. You know, we have our own Gen Z study and our own Gen Z lab at Edelman. But, you know, they're a really influential generation. And in fact, they're influencing other generations, right? So as a marketer and as a consumer, what's your take, you know, on Gen Z's influence? Are you seeing this day in and day out in your business?
Day in and day out. I see it all around me. You know, it used to be, I remember early in my career, some of our consumer insights work would often show women use the brands their moms introduced them to. And today it's the complete opposite. I mean, I have 55-year-old consumers telling me in focus groups, they discovered my brands because their Gen Z or millennial child raved about it. So the sphere of influence has done a complete 180, again, just in the last 10, 20 years. And I see this come to life the most on social media. So, you know, Gen Z as a generation are very social media savvy, are influencers in their own right. And my first few months at the company, we sold out of a Soap and Glory product and no one could figure out why. I was sitting in these supply chain meetings like, what is going on? And then we discovered this TikTok video that a young influencer, she's actually just a real person, but she had a lot of influence. And she was talking about her skin issues and eczema and how one of our products smoothed all of that away and how well it worked. And the product went on fire just from this one video, you know? And so obviously in beauty, influencer marketing is a huge discipline. At the time, we actually were doing influencer marketing, but not at scale. And we saw the same thing on number seven. We were selling out of our powders because people were calling it a dupe for Charlotte Tilbury. So it really, you know, it helped us decide where we want to prioritize our dollars and our resource and say, okay, we're going whole hog on influencer marketing. We're going to leverage different age groups, but including Gen Z and millennials. And today we've got hundreds of influencers on our brands. We have something that we've launched globally called the Creator Collective, which going back to that DNA of like teaching women, teaching, you know, these beauty consultants about the science of skin, we took that same concept and we're doing it for influencers. So up and rising influencers, younger influencers, we're taking them and inviting them into this collective where we teach them about the science of skin and they're able to become better influencers as a result, better beauty influencers. So there is, there's quite a bit of influencers, quite a bit of passion with Gen Z in the beauty space. It's really exciting and it makes our jobs really fun.
That is so fun. And I love that they were, you know, I always say like Gen Z is really smart and resourceful. So it's like they're pointing out the hacks and the like, yeah, do before you do.
Can I tell you what my team just proposed to me today? In my marketing leadership team today, they proposed that we do a TikTok challenge for the whole marketing team. Everyone has to create their own videos, but they want the leadership team to start. So I now have to create my own TikTok video. I'm like, I don't know how to do this. I know how to evaluate great influencer videos, but making my own, oy, watch out.
Anisha, you're pretty creative. I feel like I could already kind of see your TikTok in action. It's like a day in the life of a CMO beauty marketer.
I have to make it about products. So you'll see me like shaving my legs or something.
But I love that. And I love that idea of kind of giving it to the hands of your influencer, your creators. Now, a lot of traditional marketers would be really nervous about that, right? It's giving up your brand to others. What have you learned through that process? Like, have you had to bring other people along in the organization to say, hey, this isn't going to be a product advertisement? And they might not say everything exactly the way we would claim it. I would love to hear a little bit about some learnings from there.
Yeah, I'm having flashbacks to like legal conversations. Fortunately, I think, you know, influencer marketing is not a new thing anymore. So organizationally, people understand now. That was a debate I was having 5, 6, 7 years ago, where we really had to like push and push to get alignment internally to allow influencers to do their thing, because that's when it's really authentic and comes across more organically and, you know, has more impact on the business, is when you just allow influencers to do their thing, you know, give them the messaging points, let them experience the brand, but let them tell the story in their own words. Today, I have a little bit less of a battle on that because, like I said, we've been doing influencer marketing for so long. But we do still have a little bit of push and pull around when we have a partnership with someone and a piece of content comes back and it may not represent the brand in some way. What do we do with that? Do we allow it to run or do we not? Do we feel it represents the broader set of our consumers or do we feel it's offensive? You know, those kinds of things. You don't want to edit too much, but you also have to stay brand right. And so I definitely would advise not dictating the messaging. Get your key messages on a piece of paper and let them tell the story how they want. But you have to, you know, you have to stay true to your brand and make sure you're representing your brand and your consumer the right way.
That's great. I think that freedom and that ability to like kind of let go is actually kind of the future and having some guardrails to say like, okay, this is when it goes too far, is helpful, but also to say like, we can't dictate, it can't be a script. It can't be, this isn't an actor or actress that we're paying.
That's where people like you come in with issue management teams, crisis management, right?
Yeah.
When we run into those kinds of situations.
Exactly. Okay, so here's a fun one. So what's your favorite beauty trend right now?
There's so many. I was actually just reading Reddit threads because we try to stay on top of those trends. So a couple of the big ones that I think are super interesting, they're also influencing our product pipelines and things like that. One is around the ingredients in beauty products. That has been a trend for quite a few years now. And, you know, you just take the skincare space, for example, retinols are huge, hyaluronic acids are huge, vitamin C's are huge. But what's happening now is brands are coming out with combination products. So, you know, consumers are demanding, they don't want only hyaluronic acid or only vitamin C. So there's a lot of products coming out that have, you know, the combination of ingredients. And it's interesting to see the influence it has on consumers, because the way that you go to market with your claims, the way that you kind of talk about benefits becomes a little blurred when you have so many ingredients in there, you know, and you talk about a little piece of signage on a shelf in a retail store where you can only say one thing versus an influencer video where you can tell a broader story. How do you prioritize? So that's one trend. Another one that we're seeing that is influencing our Soap and Glory product pipeline is around taking skincare benefits and putting them into body products. So the benefits that you would see in serums, you know, concentrated ingredients, potent formulas, how do you translate that to body care? So that's another one that I think is super interesting and we're working on.
You know, we talked about number seven as a direct-to-consumer brand owned by a major retailer. As you think about straddling the role between a traditional CPG beauty brand and moving into a D2C brand, what learnings have you taken from those two operating models colliding?
Two things. Number seven has a pretty healthy DTC business, and that is a whole different skill set as a marketer. And so ensuring that I'm recruiting the right talent, building the right training for things like performance media or A/B testing, you know, moving fast and furious is one part of merging skill sets in an organization that has both CPG and DTC. And I think the second thing that comes to mind is traditionally in CPG businesses, because you don't transact on your website, you don't have access to first party data. And that's starting to change. CPG businesses are starting to build their own databases and transact on their sites. But the vast majority of sales come from the retailers. And so you're buying second and third party data. We have a real advantage at Number 7 Beauty Company being owned by Walgreens that we have access to this enormous database of first-party data, right? It's 100 million users. It's almost the size of Amazon Prime. And we have access to it. So it gives us a much bigger data advantage than most CPG businesses, even when we're enacting the CPG parts of our business. So I think that is one way that the worlds have collided, where you get a little bit of the benefit of being, you know, DTC, who is the DTC or businesses are the ones that have this data advantage and these huge databases, but we get to blend that into CPG. And so as CMO, you know, it's my responsibility to make sure we're set up for success there. So we've been through a digital transformation over the last few years to make sure we're implementing the right MarTech, like Adobe solutions, for example, so that we can house and leverage that data, making sure that our marketers are trained. So we've trained all 1,000 of our marketers on this custom built digital training program. We've brought some paid media in-house. We've brought some content creation in-house as part of, you know, our digital transformation. So it's not just the access to the first party data, but it's also making sure the org is set up for success and org design is thought of so that you can really take advantage.
I think that's such an interesting example to our point earlier of just how dynamic the CMO role has changed, right? When I think about all the things that we're talking about, you know, digital transformation, leveraging first party data, influence, and how you're, you know, kind of letting go of your brand. And you think about the CMO role maybe 10, 15 years ago, where it was really much around controlling the narrative around your brand communications. I almost wonder from your perspective, like how much of that is still a part of your role?
Yeah, I mean, it is. So it's still my job to build a brand positioning and have a point of difference and articulate that to consumers in a compelling way. But the difference today is I want other people saying it even more than I'm saying it myself, you know? So whether it's influencers, key opinion leaders, editors, consumers, I want them telling my brand story because that's what's going to drive influence and new buyers versus just brand content. So that's a little bit of the difference versus, you know, again, when I started my career and it was all the effort was on this big TV ad, you know, nothing else.
That's so cool. So it sounds like you guys truly are taking the trends from influencers on TikTok and really looking to see how that can drive innovation at scale.
Yeah, we take our insight from lots of different places. So, you know, social media trends, social conversation, that sort of thing. We also talk to talk to consumers all the time. We do ethnography studies like many companies, you know, sitting in their house watching their behaviors. So the insights on what products to develop or how to message to a consumer comes from a lot of different places. But definitely social media, TikTok is one of them.
So I want to wrap up a little bit, but I wanted to get a little bit more personal with you, Anisha. You know, I think I've always gravitated towards you as another South Asian Indian woman, Indian American woman in this industry. And I love to see and watch your rise. It's been really inspiring for me personally to see you rise in this industry.
Oh my gosh, I feel the same about you. You're a rock star.
What have you learned through this process? And what do you feel like your sort of superpower has been in the beauty industry? And when you think about like your legacy, how do you want to leave the legacy on the beauty industry?
Well, in terms of superpowers, I think the bias for action has always been one, you know, I'm a driver. But as I've gotten more senior, really learning more of the empathy, more of the, you know, how to bring people along, how to get others, drive action through others, even when their personalities are different than yours. Those are some of the things that have become more superpowers versus earlier in my career where I was just a driver, like almost a bulldozer, you know, to get things done. But in terms of my legacy, going back to we're both South Asian women, there aren't a lot of senior South Asian women still, you know, and I think we've had so many amazing conversations about diversity and especially representation at the top. And to be a woman and an Indian woman who can engage in those conversations and have some amount of power to change, you know, the representation at the top levels is really exciting to me. And so I think if I were to leave one legacy, it would be have more people like me, whether that's women, brown, you know, just people of color in general. But I love supporting those initiatives. So that would be the thing I'd want to be my legacy.
I love that. Well, thank you again for joining today. This has been a great conversation. I think I'm so fascinated of how you guys are, you know, really balancing that digital, offline, online world, taking heritage brands and bringing them into the future and continuing to really be on the cutting edge of trend. So this is such a great conversation, and we're so excited. So thank you again for joining the pod.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.